Hi, this is Eric Schlein with the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Songfinch. Songfinch is a personalized gifting company that brings you stories, feelings, and memories to life through one-of-a-kind songs. With the option to have a song created from scratch or to personalize an existing song foundation, their community of professional songwriters will handcraft the most personal gift that you can give. It's the perfect gift for anniversaries, weddings, Mother's Day, Father's Day, birthdays, and any other of life's special occasions. Songs start at only $99, and they're delivered within 7 days. They work with over 300 professional musicians, so your one-of-a-kind song will sound like it belongs on the radio and not just a corny jingle. So once completed, your song lives on a personal web link called your story homepage, where you can listen and download the song, read the lyrics, learn about your songwriter, and share your song on social platforms. Use promo code INVEST at checkout for 10% off your song from scratch and give the best gift that you've ever given.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Scott Thompson on. He is the founder of Ameritrust Group. Welcome on to the show, Scott.
Thanks, Eric. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit. Where are you calling from, first of all?
Yeah, Ameritrust Group, we're based in sunny, warm Tampa, Florida.
All right, right on. So a little bit colder than the Northeast, huh?
Yeah, Florida, I think it was about 85 degrees here in mid-February, so it's a great place to do winter and avoid the cold.
So now for the listeners, tell us a little bit about what exactly you do.
Sure. Ameritrust Group, we're a value investing-based firm. We follow the principles of Warren Buffett, and we seek to acquire undervalued assets, and we look for bargains, just like Buffett does. However, Buffett's working with billions; we're only working with millions. But we apply the very similar value investing strategies.
But and a lot of the strategies and that you're applying, you're doing a lot of stuff regarding real estate, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
It's a little different than a lot of the people in the value world.
Yeah, exactly. You can find value in asset classes, and real estate is an excellent asset class. And we look for assets that are undervalued that offer asymmetric risk with return. So when we buy assets, the assets that we've chosen have been performing very, very well. Currently, just for an example, our firm currently pays out an annual distribution or dividend yield of about 5.12% currently, and that continues to increase as our income increases.
All right. Now, so we'll talk about a few things. I want to get a little bit better understanding of sort of your investment philosophies in regards to real estate, sort of your process behind that. And then also want to get into your book as well. I know you have a book, and I know that actually Peter Buffett wrote a little bit at the beginning on your book, and it's an awesome book. So we'll get to that in a little bit as well. But I wanted to ask you, how did you start your firm? What had you, decide, hey, I'm not going to really focus on stocks anymore. I'm going to start applying my value philosophy more towards real estate. And then what's your day-to-day process? Three questions there, but I'm curious.
Sure. There's actually a great video that you could see. There's a great quote by Warren Buffett, and he mentions that if he were to invest in real estate, most people don't know about this, Buffett actually said this, that he would invest in single-family housing, buying in bulk at discounts to their intrinsic value or to their market value. So Buffett says he would buy single-family homes at a discount, and Buffett says he would buy them at, with a very low interest rate, say 4%, and then hold them for 5 to 7 years. And over time, the value of the underlying assets would appreciate, and during that time, he would fees come from the rents. And something like the stocks, whose volatility can go up or down, you know, for example, in October 2008, the stock market went down by 40%. You know, Buffett says, think about the underlying business. Don't necessarily be distracted too much by prices. So think about productive assets. And when Buffett talks about productive assets, he's talking about farms that produce income from crops. He's talking about real estate that produces income from the rents. And productive assets like that. And, you know, stocks can be productive assets as well if they have regular recurring dividends. But the stock market is definitely more prone to price volatility. And we all saw what happened to tech stocks in the late 1990s, as well as the market decline of close to 40% in October 2008. So even in Buffett's own words, he mentioned that he would invest in single-family housing bought at a discount to intrinsic value.
Now, so, and then what are you looking at when it comes to real estate? I mean, are you looking at single-family housing or?
We do have a portfolio of single-family housing. We're also looking at commercial properties, multi-unit properties. We're looking at several properties right now performing our due diligence, some potential seven-figure acquisitions that we're looking at. I just traveled to northern Florida and looked at a potential opportunity, a seven-figure acquisition. That particular deal, we're still doing our due diligence. And that's just some examples of the real estate that we're acquiring right now. But everything we acquire is acquired at below market value or less than its intrinsic value. And it's not just price. It's not quantitative only. It's also qualitative. So in real estate, you know, Buffett has his four filters where, you know, Buffett will look at it's got to be a business he understands. He looks at it has to have a durable competitive advantage. It has to have able and trustworthy managers, which are mostly qualitative factors. And then the fourth filter Buffett uses is the attractive price. So out of Buffett's four filters, three are qualitative, and only the fourth filter is quantitative. So similar to Buffett, we look at both qualitative and quantitative factors. Some investors look at quantitative only, and you know you can run into problems if you only see things in that narrow scope of quantitative only. So it's important to kind of look at it with a holistic 360-degree perspective and consider qualitative factors as well as quantitative.
So how do you know, you say you're buying real estate below market values.
Right.
Who's going to be selling you real estate below market value?
Sure. So there's lots of ways that we can acquire. You know, one way is I guess the origin of your question would be who would sell an asset for less than its intrinsic value? Well, typically they tend to be distressed sellers, and you know there's a number of reasons why sellers may be distressed. You know, maybe there's a foreclosure, maybe there's a event in the family that is forcing them to make the sale. But for a number of reasons, a large number of sellers need to sell their properties at, you know, less than market value, or maybe the property needs some work. You know, it's not in the best condition. It's going to require that investor come in and invest more capital to turn the property around. So there's a number of reasons why sellers might sell at less than market value. Those are just very few of a wide range of reasons why sellers would sell assets for, you know, less than their intrinsic value.
And where do you find opportunities like this? I mean, the average person, let's say they kind of get these principles already, and they say, "I want to, you know, start investing in real estate." You know, how would you recommend someone start searching for these kinds of ideas in their local areas?
Sure. Well, just based in Tampa here, you know, we acquire throughout the state of Florida. Currently, we're expanding into the southeast of. We're also looking at properties in Georgia and some other states in the southeast. And, you know, in some ways that investors could find undervalued assets is, you know, they could look for a real estate agent. They could go to the county and look at foreclosures, tax deed foreclosures. They could, you know, buy lists. They could find companies with a simple internet search of companies that sell lists of foreclosures in that range. But myself, knowing the Tampa market, it's 2018 right now. You know, back in mid-2016, I mean, the flipping market is pretty much over. It pretty much cranked out here in Florida. What I mean by that is it's so difficult to find properties to flip. So really the market currently in late 2016 and 2017, and even now in 2018, investors are switching more to a income model where they're buying properties for income. And I just see a lot of investors making mistakes down here. It seems that they are just, you know, buying properties for close to at or even higher than their intrinsic value or market value. It's just amazing to me. One quick example is I was at a property auction, and you know, we saw a property that we believe would be worth about $400,000 after it would be renovated. And the auction started off about $150,000, so we knew, you know, if we could buy it for like $150,000 to $180,000. Well, the auction quickly blew past $200,000, quickly blew past $200,000, $300,000, and then $400,000, which was the value of the property even after renovation. And that property would require about another $100,000 easy of renovation. So whoever bought that property for $400,000 full market value still has to invest at least another $100,000 to turn it around. So they just signed up to lose money. And rational, disciplined investors like me, I'd rather walk away than overpay. And that's a key point I want to make is, you know, investors get all emotional, too emotional. As a savvy investor, you have to control your emotions or put the emotions aside. And the key point I want to make here is I'd rather walk away than overpay. And that's, you know, very calm, rational, disciplined investor. And that's something that is very difficult for a lot of investors. And, you know, Eric, you're a value investor. Yeah. That if it really takes a certain type of temperament, and, you know, you get it. I've known you for years. And, you know, many value investors or people that call themselves value investors, you know, some have the temperament, some don't.
And there's a lot of charlatans in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I would say to help people, if you don't have the temperament, value investing might not be for you. You have to select a value investing method that works for you. So if you have the temperament, great, value investing will work for you. But you just can't, you know, decide to be a value investor if you're, you know, fidgety. You can't, as Buffett says, sit in a room calmly for hours, which is what he does. He sits there calmly and reads. So it really takes a calm, rational temperament. And a lot of times, temperament is even more important than the math that goes into investing, because a lot of people can do the math, but they blow it.
Yeah, I've known quite a few intelligent people in my life that you explain value investing to them, and either they just don't get it, or so clearly don't have the temperament to really, you know, implement it.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's definitely true.
So intelligence, I think, is just one part of the equation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, temperament is just so important. And when I attend the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meetings with Buffett, Mr. Buffett and Mr. Munger, they constantly talk about how important the temperament is. And I think that's something that a lot of the investors miss, because they're just looking at ways. What's the formula? Everyone wants the formula. What's the formula? Well, great, you can have the formula. There's many formulas, but you can't rely on quantitative only. And then you got to look at qualitative, and the temperament is so important.
Yeah, and there's also formula hopping, where people who don't have the temperament and want to find a formula is, if something stops working, they'll jump to the whatever is working, and that typically is a pretty poor strategy as well.
Absolutely, that's a great point. And with value investing, there's something called opportunity cost. So just to say yes to one investment, like the example I gave of the unfortunate investors who paid $400,000 for an asset worth $400,000 that's going to require another $100,000 into it. You know, there's opportunity cost. So because they said yes to that investment, well, now there's $500,000 less that they can allocate to another investment. And what if, you know, a few days later, a week later, they come across another investment that, you know, we might discover that might be worth, you know, $400,000 that we could acquire for, let's say, less than $200,000. Well, we've got, you know, more than a 50% margin of safety. You know, it's completely different. And here's another great key to value investing is you make your money when you buy. You know, if that investor is paying $400,000 for a $400,000 house, you know, we're paying less than $200,000 for a $400,000 house. You know, we're obviously buying right. And again, you make your money when you buy.
Yeah, absolutely.
you know, if you don't buy right, you can't fix it down the road. It's like marrying the wrong person. You know, it's, you know, you have to make the right decision up front from square one. And right. And if you overpay on day one,
you're screwed.
You really can't. So it's important to buy right.
Yes. Interesting. So just to go back, something I was asking before, you know, for the average individual that would want to get into real estate investing, do you think it's a little bit easier going with a broker or, you know, actually manually scrolling through foreclosures? Just because how would someone get a sense of how much money would need to be put in to renovate something? I mean, how do you do that due diligence?
Sure. Well, if you acquire a property, you first have to have a sense of how to value the property. And in real estate, for example, it's very similar to when businesses are sold. When businesses are sold, they look at the, you know, there's many ways to value. One valuation method is they'll look at the net income and they'll assign a multiple to the net income. So let's say the net income is X and they assign a multiple of, you know, 5X or 7X or 10X of the net income, and that's the valuation of the business. With real estate, it works a little bit differently, but it's actually based on the comparable market sales. So in real estate, let's say a four-bedroom and two-bath house with, you know, 2,000 square feet sells at, you know, let's say, $300,000 or something like that. If all the houses in that neighborhood and, let's say, a half-mile or one-mile radius sell for that price based on square footage, you can divide the price by the square footage, get the cost per square foot, and that's what the property would be worth per square foot, and that's how the appraisers tend to look at properties. There's a lot of variables. I'm obviously oversimplifying.
Right.
But it's so real estate would sell based on comparable properties, you know, and businesses that would trade, you know, they would sell based on market comp, where if a business sold at like 10x multiple on the net income, you know, so there are some similarities between stocks and real estate. So once the investor can value the property, then that's key. If you know if the property would sell at, let's say, 400 and it's, you know, in a foreclosure on sale for, let's say, 150 or 180 or 200, you know you've got more than a 50% margin of safety. And then at that point, if they don't have any real estate experience, they should hire a general contractor to come through and who's licensed and give them an estimate on materials and labor. If someone has no experience, I wouldn't recommend they just jump in. I would recommend that they have a mentor and, you know, shadow that mentor and work under them for a number of years. I mean, just to jump in with money or someone else's money, I wouldn't recommend that. But definitely seek the advice of professionals who are learning from them.
Yeah. Interesting. So now let's jump to your book. So tell us about your book. What's it called for all our listeners out there?
Sure. The book is called Art and Science of Value Investing by Scott Thompson.
Who's you? And that's you.
That's me. Right. Right.
What inspired you to write? You know, there's all these value investing books out there. What had you want to write a book?
Sure. I read all the value investing books at that time, and a lot of them had different perspectives, and they're all very helpful. And what I saw is a lack of a book that really was like a step-by-step book that would take these complex, you know, value investing methods used by the world's most successful value investors, like, you know, Ben Graham, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, Phil Fisher, and more. And I thought it was important to explain each valuation model in a very simple, easy to understand step-by-step process. And so the readers could learn the value to value businesses, stocks, and bonds, and estimate the intrinsic value, similar to the way that Buffett and some of the other investors do. And more importantly, you know, the book will help readers discover how to use both qualitative and quantitative factors to identify, you know, high quality undervalued assets to buy. And if they follow those principles, I believe that it would transform their financial life.
That's awesome. You have any other books in the works, or?
I have a book I'm writing at the moment, but it's in process, so I don't want to talk too much about it right now. But
I'm
a doer, not a talker, right. And like this book just came out. People didn't even know I was working on it. It took me 2 years to write that book, and you know, working more than full time and writing the book, it was very demanding. But I clearly saw an opportunity in the market where I believed that the book would help a lot of people, and that was really the point. Is I believe that people can really benefit from the book just based on its the book's ability to communicate the complex topics in ways that are very simple and easy to understand. And here's the key, easy to understand, step-by-step process. So, you know, like Buffett went through several valuation models of, he did the net-net, you know, the NNWC, net-net working capital, early on in his partnership. And then he transitioned more into qualitative investing with the influences of Phil Fisher and Charlie Munger, incorporating in more qualitative factors. And then Buffett went to more of a DCF method of a discounted cash flow. And then recently, I shouldn't say recently, but, you know, relatively recently based on the other valuation methods, Warren Buffett announced in his annual report that he announced the two-column method. And most people have never even heard of the two-column method that Buffett uses. And my book is one of the only value investing books in the world that clearly explains and breaks down Buffett's two-column method. And if I remember, I think Buffett put the two-column method on page 6 of his 2010 annual report and page 9 of his 2011 annual report. It just sticks out in my mind. I kind of have a photographic memory. And so I'm glad that my book could explain topics of valuation methods of Warren Buffett that I haven't found in any other books. If there's another book that explains Buffett two-column method, I'm not aware of it. I just don't know that there's another book that explains it. So I think that was definitely another aspect of my book that I could really help investors and benefit them and help them become more successful value investors by breaking down and explaining and showing them, explaining it step by step, you know, Buffett's two-column method as well as the other methods that I talked about earlier, the DCF and the net working capital and plenty of others.
For the listeners, tell us exactly what you mean by the two-column method.
Oh, sure. Good question. I kind of got ahead of myself. So, yeah, Warren Buffett's two-column method.
That's what I'm here for.
Great question. So Warren Buffett's two-column valuation method is where, you know, he looks at on the balance sheet. He starts on the balance sheet, and at the top of the balance sheet, Warren Buffett looks at the stocks, bonds, and cash equivalents of the business, and he'll add up all of those assets together. And that will be called pre-tax investments. And then Warren will go over to the income statement, another financial statement, and maybe like third of the way down, there's something called operating income. And operating income, Warren will take that operating income and he will assign a multiple to it based on the multiple of what other businesses are selling for currently at that time. And let's say we assign a multiple of, you know, let's say 8 or 10 or 9. It just depends on what the current multiple is at that time, but let's just say, you know, 8. So we'll assign an 8x multiple on the operating income that's on the income statement, and then that's the pre-tax operating income. Now, if you just simply add those two numbers together of the pre-tax investments with the pre-tax operating earnings with the multiple, then that gives you what Buffett calls the intrinsic value of the business using this two-column method. And my book explains in a lot more detail how to do that in a very simple, easy-to-understand method.
Interesting. What are some other parts of the book that you think would be valuable to share on the show? Can you talk about maybe one or two, you know, models or valuations or any interesting tidbits?
Sure. You know, Ben Graham wrote The Security Analysis in 1934 and also then Intelligent Investor book in 1949. And Ben Graham was Warren Buffett's mentor. And when Warren Buffett got a no from Harvard that Harvard wouldn't allow him to attend his business school there, Warren Buffett applied at Columbia University, where Buffett learned from the great Benjamin Graham. So Ben Graham was Buffett's mentor and value investing professor at Columbia University. And that really, you know, the people who are around seeing that in class, that, you know, sparks are flying between the two, and that, you know, Warren would finish Graham's sentences, and Warren just learned so much from Ben Graham. So, yeah, to answer your question, my book talks about the net-net working capital value investing method that, you know, Buffett in his early days was achieving returns of, you know, 30, 40, even 50% on some of the stock investing he was doing. And that's in my book. Also, it talks about how Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's co-chair of Berkshire Hathaway, and also another value investor, Phil Fisher. And Charlie Munger and Phil Fisher incorporate more qualitative factors into their investing, where Buffett was just strictly quantitative, strictly Ben Graham. And through the influence of Charlie Munger and Phil Fisher, Warren Buffett was really influenced by them, and Warren Buffett started to incorporate more of the qualitative factors of Charlie Munger and Phil Fisher into his value investing. And that led to the development of another business, another investing model in my book, and that's the four filters. Filter one is seek a business you understand. Since it's outside your level of confidence, just move on to another business. And then filter two of the four filters of Buffett Munger, filter two is that the business must possess a durable competitive advantage. And filter three is that business must have able and trustworthy managers. And filter four is it must be attractive price compared to the intrinsic value of the underlying business. And here's a key point I want to make, Eric, is that, you know, stocks are not lottery tickets. It's actually a fractional ownership share of the underlying business. And I think a lot of investors are not investors, they're more speculators or gamblers. Right. I'm truly a disciplined, rational value investor, where I think a lot of investors are more speculators. And so that's a key point I want to make. Stocks are not lottery tickets. Instead, they're fractional ownership shares of the underlying business. And if you can't, if one can't learn how to value the business, you know, they really have no business buying the stock, because how do they know what the business is worth? And that's really the key. One of the powerful and simple examples in my book is I talk about, let's say I have a $100 Amazon gift card. It's worth $100. And I say, Eric, how would you like to buy this $100 Amazon gift card for $50? Well, yes, you take that deal. That's a good deal, right? It's worth $100. You only pay $50. That's a good deal.
Yeah.
But what if I said, Eric, I have a $100 Amazon gift card. Would you pay me $200 for it? Well, that's a bad deal, because you would lose $100. Why would you pay $200 of your capital for an asset that's only worth $100? So now I say, instead of a $100 gift card, you know, what if it's a, let's say, a $100,000 house? You know, you'd rather pay $50,000 for a $100,000 house as opposed to paying $200,000 for a $100,000 house. And the key is you have to learn how to value the asset. If one can't value the asset, they shouldn't invest. And in my book, powerful empowers the reader of how to value assets,
yep,
whether it's stocks, bonds, and in the book. And then we talk about discounted cash flow method that Buffett uses, that was initiative number 1938, and also Buffett's two-column method. And in addition to the models, there's just a wealth of information. There's so much that's packed in there. And again, the key is to explain it, communicate it to the reader in ways that are easy and simple to understand in a step-by-step method.
No, I think it's interesting that you had Peter Buffett write a little thing at the beginning. How did that come about?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, I was really blessed. Peter Buffett wrote the foreword in my book, Art and Science of Value Investing. And I first met Peter in 2009. He's very genuine, just the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. And I showed him some drafts of the book. I set him the table of contents. And it was clear, you know, he was interested. And then I sent him the chapter on philanthropy. So there's 16 chapters in the book. And the 16th and final chapter in the book is on philanthropy. And I believe, you know, Peter really liked the value investing content. But I also know that he really liked the chapter 16, which is called Responsible Philanthropy. And, you know, Peter, as you remember, Warren Buffett gifted the bulk of his foundation, bulk of his money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. But Warren also gave $5 billion to the Susan Thompson Foundation, and then $1 billion each to each of his three kids. So, you know, obviously Peter was a recipient of $1 billion, and I believe that has actually more than tripled since the gift was made in the mid-2000s. I believe that was around 2006, I believe. So Peter wrote the foreword, and I was really impressed with the foreword Peter wrote, because it talks about that this book will teach people how to make money. It will. That's what it does. It's effective at it. But what happens when you've made the money? Peter really likes the book because chapter 16 is responsible philanthropy, and therefore after the readers learn how to make money by reading my book, that the book also teaches how to responsibly give it away. And I know that Peter really liked that as well.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and Peter, for those that don't know, he's a very talented musician, and he runs the foundation, giving away, like I said, he was the recipient of, $1 billion of his father's major gift, and that is more than tripled. But Peter's very talented. He actually wrote the fire dance scene. He composed the music in the movie of Kevin Costner Dances with Wolves. Warren Buffett composed the music for the fire dance scene, which received, I believe, an Emmy Award. So most people don't know that about him.
Composed that.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's that?
I said you mean Peter Buffett composed that?
Yeah, Peter Buffett composed the music. Yeah, correct. Yeah, correct.
I've heard Warren Buffett play the You Can Sing, not the best.
Warren's very entertaining. I've seen him at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting, singing with the Fruit of the Loom guys, since Berkshire Hathaway owns that company as well. And Warren has a great sense of humor. I've met him. He's just a wonderful person, great sense of humor. And with all his success, he is just so down to earth and warm and friendly. And it's really, he leads by example. He's very real and authentic, and a great opportunity I had to be able to meet him in person.
Yeah. What was the highlight of meeting Warren?
My phone cut out a little bit there. Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah. What was your highlight of meeting Warren, would you say?
There was so much. We talked for probably, 30 minutes in person, and I mentioned some things about valuation and, some things he couldn't answer, which I respect. I think that what I take away the most was his sense of humor, his authenticity, and how warm he was. He's, very intelligent. He reads, over 8 hours a day for, decades and decades, over 50 decades. And despite all that, he did not come off as anything other than just warm and friendly, just very gracious and a great sense of humor. He played off my sense of humor and I played off of his. And I remember one point of conversation, he goes, "This is great. It's very funny." He goes, "We should be recording this." And I said, "Yeah." But just very, very warm, friendly guy, with all his knowledge and success. He just keeps it real. And he's everything that he comes across as being. There's no arrogance. It's just a strong sense of humility. Those are some of the things I remember most when meeting him.
That's great. Awesome. Is there anything else you'd like to share while you're on the show?
Yeah, I was looking at some of the market caps of some of the other stocks, and boy, isn't it a surprise that after everything Buffett says of not investing in technology companies, it's interesting that Berkshire is now invested in Apple, yes, of all companies. Yes. So that's kind of a surprise. And I was looking at some of the market caps. So Apple has a market cap of $877 billion. Mm-hmm. And then below that, Google currently has a market cap of about $770 billion. And then below that, Amazon has a market cap of $720 billion. And then Berkshire has a market of about $500 billion. And then, so it's interesting that, I wonder who's going to be the first $1 trillion market cap company. But there's, four strong candidates, and who knows? Maybe it'll be Apple, it might be Google, Alphabet, maybe it'll be Amazon, maybe it's Berkshire. Who knows? But I thought that's interesting.
If you had to make a bet, what do you think it would be, just for fun?
It's hard to say. If you look at the financial statements of all of those companies, Berkshire right now has $109 billion in cash. I mean, just cash sitting there. And why isn't that allocated? He must not be able to find opportunities to invest that cash. So that's a good problem to have, because in the early days, you remember Buffett was finding more opportunities. There's more opportunities than he had cash. And now it's the opposite. Now Buffett has more cash than there are opportunities. They're both problems, but what a great problem to have.
You have $109 billion.
Right, first world problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Apple, Google, and Amazon are tech stocks. That's not in my circle of confidence.
Yeah.
So You know, like Buffett says, if it's outside your circle of competence, just, you know, go somewhere else where you can be right. Yeah. And, you know, the great thing about real estate is I start with the end in mind. When we invest, we know it's a winner before we even put our money up. So we have certainty in that probability, and we already know the outcome before we put the money in. So just imagine having understanding the market and the business that well and thoroughly. And since inception, you know, Ameritrust has never lost money on any deal.
It's amazing.
And it's an amazing track record. We currently pay out a 5.12 annual dividend to investors, and that's based on the rents and the income coming in. And that's only going to continue to grow higher if things continue the way they're going. And then the appreciation, our appreciation, you know, we've got properties that have appreciated double digits, over 10% a year, some 11% per year, some 12% per year. So imagine if you have an unrealized gain on the property of, let's say, you know, 10% per year over, you know, 2 years, that's 20%. And then, you know, the annual dividend is currently 5.12%. So if you get 5% per year times two, that's 10. And then if you get 10% per year times two, that's 20. Well, 20 plus 10, that's 30 over 2 years divided by two. I mean, that's 15% per year. You know, given that 5% is realized and the other 10% is unrealized, but still, you know, on paper, a 15% return on average is what we're doing. You know, we don't lose money since inception. We're all cash, by the way. We don't have any debt, which is even stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, Warren Buffett always talks about, you know, look for businesses with little to no debt. We have no debt. We have owned all of our assets free and clear with no debt. And it's hard to get – that's hard for people to get their head around. They say, well, Scott, how much are your mortgages? There are none. Well, what interest rate? Interest on what? We have no debt. It's all cash, you know. So
let me ask you something. Why are you opposed to borrowing money to buy some of these properties when you're buying them at such a significant discount and with your, yep, your kind of track record?
That's a great question. And my answer is anyone who makes that argument is 100% right. I cannot win that argument. But the reason is something they might not think about it. And when you're raising capital, investors, you know, tend to ask a gotcha question. And they'll say, well, how much debt do you have? And a lot of time, these firms are just levered up, just significantly high. And they don't have the Rock of Gibraltar balance sheet we have. And then the investor, potential investor says, well, what happens if there's a market downturn? Well, if there's a market downturn, you know, like Buffett says, you don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out. Yeah. So in other words, to translate Buffett's colloquialism, you know, you don't know who's levered high until the market drops and then people get the margin calls. Well, we can't get a margin call because we don't owe any money. So when we get the question of what happens if there's a market downturn, well, most people, I shouldn't say everyone else, but most others lose money, and then we're the Rock of Gibraltar balance sheet. You know, I love being in that strong Rock of Gibraltar balance sheet position that we're not beholden to anybody. We don't owe anyone any money. We're just buying assets for cash. So to raise capital, it's extremely helpful to raise capital. That's why we have our capital flows accessible as we are. But with debt, it just tends to turn away investors. And even though the returns can be better, you know, sometimes investors could lose sleep with higher leverage debt amounts. But you're right. Just on paper, if someone is levered up, they're going to show a higher return on equity because of the debt and extending themselves. But, you know, I sleep very soundly at night. We've got no debt, and we're not beholden to anyone. We've got the Rock of Gibraltar balance sheet strength. And if you think about it, a balance sheet is pretty much two things. It's assets and liabilities. And we've got all assets minus what? Minus zero?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's extremely the financial strength of Ameritrust is outstanding. I mean, I don't know other businesses that are run that way. And we're frugal with the expenses. We'll pay what we need, but and we don't sacrifice quality. You know, we don't sacrifice the quality, but we just watch the expenses, and we don't have any debt. We understand our business extremely well. We haven't lost money since inception on any deal. It's fun. I love what I do, and that's really the key. I've got the value investing temperament. I can sit in cash if we need to, calm, rational, disciplined. You know, I understand Buffett, the value investing methods, all the models he's used, and it's a lot of fun. We're having fun. It's a great place to be down here in Tampa. The weather's great, and And the people I work with are fantastic. So, you know, it's like Buffett says, he tap dances to work. I'm not much of a tap dancer, but I sure love what I do, too. I know that's what he means. He loves what he does. So, and I've seen you, Eric, at the shareholder meetings, and you understand if anyone gets the value investing philosophy, it's you. So it's of all the philosophies that I've looked at, and I think you've looked at, you know, you'd have to agree, you know, or would you agree? It just makes sense.
It just, yeah. I personally see value investing less of a philosophy per se, but more of a, you know, these are the basic principles of what investing actually is when you break it down.
Right. Right. It's kind of redundant, value investing. I mean, if you're not value investing, what are you doing? I mean, yeah. Value investing implies buy low, sell high. I mean, what else is there?
Right.
You buy high, sell low. I mean, unless you're shorting, you know, but buy low, sell high just makes sense. It's
anyone who puts value investing as, oh, that's your strategy, you know, a value investment strategy, doesn't really get what someone means by value investing, because it's, I think it's less a strategy more of I understand what I'm doing around investing, essentially.
Right. Yeah, it's worked. And, you know, if you look at, you know, option strategies or commodities or where's their billionaire? Where's the options billionaire? Where's he at? Where's the commodities billionaire? You know, even if there are billionaires, you know, Warren Buffett remains the wealthiest investor in the history of the world. You know, his net worth is now, I believe it was $72 billion when I last checked.
Yeah.
Maybe it's up higher. And that's after he's given away billions to his foundations. You know, is any options trader worth $72 billion? Is any commodities trader worth $72 billion? And commodities, are, you know, that there's definitely a need for that. And same thing with options. I'm not knocking those. I'm just saying, you know, Warren Buffett has achieved his financial success through value investing. And it's just been an incredible run. I mean, his year-over-year returns is something close to 20%. And, boy, I'm sure looking forward to receiving the Berkshire Hathaway annual letter in about 48 hours. So this is being recorded, you know, 2 days, 48 hours before Berkshire Hathaway's annual report is published. So I'm sure looking forward to that. I'll devour that and go through all the value investing analysis and read his annual letter to shareholders. I love doing that every year.
And you know, I always love your perspective. So maybe I'll even if you want, I'll bring you back on and we can talk about the letter.
Sure, that sounds great. That sounds great. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Eric.
Yeah, likewise. And if people want more information about what you do, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Sure. They could visit the website for Ameritrust Group, and the web address is www.ameritrustcorp.com, and I'll spell that. It's www.ameritrustcorp.com. So Ameritrust Corp, all one word, .com.
Okay, sounds good. And we'll put some stuff on the show notes for people who want links to the book or links to your website or anything like that.
Sure. And the book, Art and Science of Value Investing, with a foreword by Peter Buffett, it's available at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Walmart. I mean, it's available everywhere.
Right.
Just search on Art and Science of Value Investing, and you'll find the book. I hope it benefits you. I believe it will.
All right, great. Thanks so much, Scott. I appreciate having you on.
All right. Thanks, Eric. All the best to you.
Thanks. You too.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.